Welcome to our third segment here. We're for Street Bowl in an office that many people that have led the state have came and talked politics, and we're here to talk politics. The third segment about Senator Richards' time in the serving in the Senate and serving as pro tem. Thank you for having us here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure that you come to my business. It's very gracious of you.
So you file for a Senate and no one files against you.
Right.
I mean, I think you were Speaker of the House. You probably figured you're going to win, but did you expect to go two terms unopposed? Without even a...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, number one, I can outwork everybody and I can raise more money than God. What's not to like about that, dude?
Tell me about that. I've asked you sideways, but I'll just straight ask you, why can you raise more money than other people?
Because I ask them. And I have a track record that I do what I say and I mean what I say. And I don't lie.
So you just for the campaign people that love campaigns,
yeah.
You sit in a room and say, I got to raise $1 million for this campaign to fund whatever you're going to fund.
Yeah.
Do you just sit in a room with a list and start making calls? Do you hit the
I get in the car and go see them face to face, yeah. And most of the money comes from St. Louis.
Well, can you tell me how when you, if the roles were reversed and you were walking in to raise money, what would that conversation start like? Just for a young politician who's intimidated raising money, they'd be a good public servant, but it's hard. Can you give them advice? When they walk in a room, how do you raise that kind of money?
Well, number one, they knew me anyway, because I'd go for 2 or 3 years, 4 years, when I was just elected, and then when I was chair of economic development, I'd go to all the metropolitan areas and all these other cities trying to figure out what they wanted. So when I walk in a room, they knew what I wanted. Bucky Bush in St. Louis,
yeah.
I went to see him one day. I got off the elevator, he met me and said, I know all about you. He read me a resume. Everything I did, what I did in Jeff City, he said, you're okay, come in, wrote me a check. That happened more times than not. Mr. McDonald Douglas said, I know you. You've done this and this. I wish you could do this and this. Here's a check. Augie Bush, same thing. My hard work set in motion a lot of different things. And I didn't get a lot of press, but people that was in the know about expanding their economy knew it was done. And my actions helped me break that ceiling.
So, and you get elected to the Senate, and then a tornado hits Joplin.
Yeah.
About what time of the year? Tell us where you were when that happened.
It was May. I was on my deck, and I was watching it go by. I thought my wife was nutty. I said, there's a big black cloud. I didn't know what was going on. And it went a quarter mile over the house and tore up 16 miles long, 2 miles wide of Joplin. Trapped my mother-in-law and everybody.
Why weren't you in the basement or somewhere? The bathroom?
I don't have a basement. Patty was in the basement. It was a bright day. I didn't see anything. I just heard a big roar. I didn't know it was that big a deal. I mean, down this part of the world, tornadoes are common.
Yeah.
So I didn't think too much about it. But as it turned out, it's horrible. And
when you saw the devastation.
It was unbelievable. It's like a lawnmower going through tall grass.
Wow.
When Nixon and I got on the helicopter, went through it, you see the town and nothing. It's like tall grass, 2 foot high, and a mower going through it. That's what it looked like.
So you knew Jay Nixon well from serving as Speaker.
Yeah.
Jay Nixon's very proud of his work in Joplin.
He was here and did what he needed to do, and he was the right guy at the right time. Yeah, he never said no down here. Never said no. And then I returned that favor to him by doing some things for him, too.
Sure. Well, there's definitely, I interviewed him back in December.
Yeah.
And there was definitely a mutual respect there.
Yeah, I mean, I always tell everybody in the press that I get along with governors about half the time. That's just about all you need to, because there's just that yin and yang. But I'll give you an example. Nixon wanted to bring more jobs to Boeing, to St. Louis, from Seattle. And we had to do some Missouri Works, quality jobs kind of stuff. And the Senate didn't want to do that until we got some tax credit reform. So we go to caucus and we talk. We must have been there 2 hours. And two or three of the guys were about the reforms and stuff. And I said, well, why don't you let me do this? Let me go to Nixon and say, if you'll freeze all the tax credits for 3 months, a quarter, until we can get some legislation, we'll go ahead and get this incentives, bring Boeing in. Oh, okay. He did. Nixon froze all the credits. The House and Senate, particularly Senate, couldn't decide what they wanted to do with the reform tax credits. Mm-hmm. We got the incentives for Boeing over, and there's 400 jobs at that pop, and there's probably a couple more over that. And that's how Boeing really started pushing back since McDonnell Douglas Day, getting more of a presence in St. Louis.
So tell me something about Jay Nixon other people don't know.
I've traveled with him around the world too. I mean, he's got a pretty good sense of humor. When you really got to work through a deal, he'll keep his word.
Mm-hmm.
That's the highest praise I give anybody.
So in 2012, there were some statewide positions open. Yeah. You'd even, when you were speaker, even talked about maybe being interested in that. People, I'm sure, came to you. Why did you not run in 2012?
Well, the tornado, and I thought Brad Lager called me when Kinder pulled out. He was running for governor, and Brad was running for lieutenant governor. He called me. He said, if you want to run for lieutenant governor, he said, I'll pull back and let you do it. I said, I can't do that. I said, these people down here are depending on somebody to try to help get this resolved. I mean, and I've got a good relationship with Roy Blunt and Claire McCaskill, and I said, I just need to pay attention. That's why they didn't send me here to do another job and run for governor when I got half the town screwed up. Well, what kind of a human being would that be? So if that was an opening for me to do something, I chose not to do it and pay attention to my town.
Any regrets not running statewide?
No. I mean, I guess I could do it again if I wanted to, but, you know, I probably could have gotten that lieutenant governor thing, but wisely they picked Mike Keel. He's the best. That guy may be the best, one of the best negotiators, and he was a great senator of it. He lives there. He's got a great future. So, I mean, that was a wise pick, Parsons. He's really great on transportation. No, I guess I might have been able to get the middle of it. I'm glad I chose not to.
You get elected in 2010. Later that week, there's a vote for pro tem. Kevin Engler was someone that thought was probably the conventional wisdom pick. Rob Mayer ends up. So I don't know if this is even kosher to ask, but I'll shoot anyway. Did they really draw straws in that room?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What was that room like? I mean, that's an interesting part of Missouri history that doesn't really get talked about much.
Well, there's some unwritten rule that if you end up having a tie after three or four, you draw straws. And I thought, that's crazy. You ought to be voting till there's a winner. And I've kind of changed that. Thank goodness it hadn't happened since then. I don't even remember. I think I was an Engler guy. I remember Kevin was majority leader, and usually I'm pretty traditional about if you know, do the job. And, but yeah, they draw straws.
There were a lot of contention followed that the next couple of years in the caucus.
Well, to Rob's credit, I mean, it's hard building consensus when you win by drawing straws, using your words. I mean, you didn't have a number of group that was that you could build on a power structure, and he always had to fight the undercurrents of maybe I should be here, maybe I shouldn't be here.
Well, that was a big freshman class as well in 2010. Did you guys look around and think, what the hell are these guys thinking? This is not the most organized thing.
Yeah. I thought I wouldn't run again. I mean, it was so bad that first couple of years with some of the nonsense going on that I thought I wouldn't run again. Jay and I, we'd get so sick of listening to that nonsense, we'd go back and play gin. Couldn't stand to look at it.
Callahan says he might have been the leader of the largest actual faction in the Senate, the Democrats. The Republicans were pretty divided against each other.
Yeah, and actually some of our guys were with Callahan.
Yeah.
He made a lot of sense on a lot of issues. I mean, some of the labors, and Torty wasn't too bad. But, you know, because he was a pretty good broker, he was an honest broker, it was the Republicans got him appointed to the tax commission. And then Callahan was one of the votes helping Ag when they did that property tax, not raising that property tax. I mean, the guy sees both sides of it.
So the China hub to me was like that special session might have been the height of the dysfunction. What, you're an economic development guy. What happened?
Well, as I remember, it just we had a lot of issues with the airport and then with the warehouses within the area trying to get that part. I mean, I think it was too big of a bite at the apple. It's still a pretty good idea, that hub. Just never could come together on a cohesive plan of what it should look like.
Was it still problems emanating out of that drawn straws, or?
I don't think so. I think because of some credits, because of some stuff with Paul McKee, with I get like the warehousing piece. I just don't think it ever had a really good solid plan of what the vision would be.
Well, watching leadership go on a fly around and say this is what we're going to do, and then did you learn anything from that helped you?
Yeah, you forgot to ask the members if you had the authority to go out and promise that, because that was also done by Steve and Rob when they went out and promised right to work and couldn't deliver. Remember that one?
I remember that one, but I remember the China Hub one.
Yeah. You need to check your hold card. Make sure, you know, it's like an old Roman soldier said, you know, you can lead the charge. You better figure out from behind you if anyone's behind you. If you're charging up the hill. I always checked behind me to see if I had someone charging up the hill with me.
So did some of that dysfunction, I would think a person that's been in charge of a business, been a mayor, been speaker, did that help motivate you to run for leadership in the next session? Was that part of the motivating factor?
No, I didn't really care about it. I got elected again. Dan Brown nominated me, had the votes, and that's fine. But I did take as much power as I could from the pro tem as well as the speaker and give it to those chairmen and make sure that I knew what their vision was, and I let them go to work. I made sure that I knew I knew what was on their mind while you're dealing with your
microphone. While we're rejiggering microphones here, yeah.
I wanted to know their mind, and then I could negotiate and do some things. But no, I really wasn't this is the way it's going to be, a firm. Now, yeah, a big, we need to do some higher ed and have a good job training. We need economic development, but you break it up in pieces. You know, are we going to do some legal reform? Are we going to do some reform on education? I mean, there's bits and pieces. I asked the chairman how they're going to fund it, and that's why we never lost.
Did you go in the Senate, though? You wanted to be in leadership when you got there?
I wanted to chair economic development, what Schmidt was doing, and I thought that'd be just fine. No, I had no vision of being in leadership in the House or Senate.
So it was Senator Brown that first come to you and said you should run for the race, and there's the votes?
No, he said you're going to win because I already got the votes.
Well, if you don't mind, when did he say that? What month? Was it after the primary?
He said about a week before the election of leadership.
Looking back on it, there were three contested primaries that elected Republicans. It looked like maybe those three people in those primaries are probably supporters of yours, right? Did that affect your decision or that vote counting?
Who are you talking about?
When Ed Emery beat Scott Largent, and then...
Oh, yeah. Although they're both... I helped both of them get elected, so, I mean, I don't even know if... And
Cunningham, Wayne Wallingford.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. I didn't go out and ask him. Dan Brown did. And he... For whatever reason, they liked my leadership style. I think they liked the fact that I talked to the caucus members and gave them the truth as I saw it. And I could help them get elected by my hard work and my fundraising, and they knew I could help with the majority.
So the person you defeated was Mike Parson for the full leader race. Coming out of that, I watched, you know, after that draw and straws, I know that Senator Engler had some misgivings about the situation.
Yeah.
Mike Parson showed back up in January and seemed to have a very different feel. He seemed like he was going to contribute, and he had, you know, at the time he probably had 6 years left. Your relationship with him seemed to improve pretty quick.
Yeah, you just cannot hold grudges. He was one of our important chairmen. And then I kid him about it. I said, you know, if it hadn't been for that race, you wouldn't be governor.
If it had went differently, would you be governor right now?
No. Probably Kehoe would be, or somebody else.
But in that, I mean, he couldn't have been as successful as he was without you agreeing to move forward and help him, right?
Well, he had a good vision on his committee.
Yeah.
And he sent out good stuff. It's easy for a guy in leadership when you have good chairman sending good stuff, put it on the counter, let the majority leader do. I mean, it makes my job easy. I didn't tell him what to do. I didn't tell these guys what to do. I asked him what some of the priorities are. I'd go to all the caucus. What are your priorities? So we'd get 30 or 40 bills, get those teed up of all the members, and then we'd filter in everybody else's. But we made that a decision when we talked together. So it was easy for me to know what priorities are, and I'd get it stacked up, and we'd get on debate, and some we passed, some we didn't.
Talk about your relationship with David Humphreys.
Yeah, I knew his dad when he owned TAMPCO, and then David and I became friends, and I don't know if it's not a close relationship, but he likes to help Joplin. I mean, he is, if it hadn't been for him during that tornado or creating jobs and companies around here, I mean, we'd have been a lot less. I mean, he's a pretty good corporate citizen here.
I found this the case with Rex Singfield and with Mr. Humphreys. It's an interesting thing, the people that want to attack them. I thought it was like, so Governor Nixon took $50,000 from the Teamsters or UAW or something after session. Now, Governor Nixon was always pro-labor. He campaigned on it. There was a seminal thing. You raised money from David Humphreys, and you've been pro-tort reform and pro-labor reform as far as I've ever known you.
Yeah.
It wasn't like you switched a position. Do you think some of those attacks get overheated and unfair?
Oh, yeah. But it's politics. So why not worry about it? I mean, just don't worry about it. I mean, not everybody can be thoughtful or, you know, it is. It's been going on that since George Washington and you don't want to look at a nasty debate. Look at Webster and Abraham Lincoln. I mean, it's supposed to be a cauldron of that you churn and you burn and you flesh out ideas. It's not supposed to be a mamby-pamby. You're a nice guy. I mean,
how do you deal with being attacked like that?
Well, at one time I didn't do it too well. I should have.
How does your wife and family deal with those attacks?
Oh, she takes it serious. She takes it personal. But then they don't like it. But it's the name of the game.
Give a piece of advice to a guy right now that's running for state rep in, let's say, wherever, Missouri.
Yeah.
And he gets a call from his wife to come home because she got a mail piece saying he's a dastardly figure.
Yeah.
How do you handle that?
Tear it up and don't read anymore.
How's your wife? How do you explain that to your wife?
Very carefully, because she's personal.
Sure.
I mean, I tell you what, I thought she tells the story too. Patty is a character. Greitens had just got elected. He was calling us all a bunch of low-life, political, whatever we were. And I just didn't pay much attention, but she took it personal. And we were at Lincoln Days, and he was coming up, because Greitens, I was working on something, and she was going to throttle him. I don't know if she was going to test his golden gloves or something. And she said, you know what saved his life? I said, Catherine Hanway came up and said, and started talking about something else. That saved his life, because I was going to throttle him. Calling you guys career corrupt politicians. Well, and you know, even the guys I don't get along with in the House and Senate, I don't know anyone that's a career politician, term limits, and corrupt. May they make bad decisions. I don't know anyone that's been corrupt.
Do you think that word's thrown around too much?
Oh, heck yeah. It's even in D.C. I mean, if it was corrupt, you'd have somebody knocking on your door throwing you in the calabash.
Speaking of Eric Greitens, what was the guy starts running I guess in 2015 at Lincoln Day. What was your first impression of him?
He was sure of himself. That's kind of my first impression. I said, this guy's really sure of himself. And he's got a lot of people around him I never heard of and I just never saw. I mean, some high-powered people, little George Peach, you know, whatever his name was. I'll tell you a story. I was sitting, and I tried to make all governors. We were going to the inauguration, and Governor Greitens walked in with the Georgia Peach. I said, Governor, is there anything I can do? Your first inauguration, you won by a pretty good number. What can I do to help? He said, we got a new idea. And then this guy, Georgia Peach, Well, we're going to go. We're rented Mizzou Arena, and we're going to open up to the whole state, and we're going to have dressed in jeans and white shirts, and we're going to have two cowboy bands. I said, well, Governor, that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard in my whole life, and we ain't going. The Senate is not going. I picked up the phone and called the Speaker. He's not going. I called everybody, all the statewide. I called Parson, Lieutenant Governor. He ain't going. I said, now, have a good time. I got people worked a lifetime walking down those marble steps in that beautiful building with their wives and kids that's going to be there. And I called Hancock, those chair. I said, Hancock, go raise me $300,000 you're putting on the party because the governor's not coming. 2 days later, he said, well, I guess we'll come. I said, it's a good idea. You'll be glad that I made you do this. And it turned out.
How many other, Senator Wasson talked about how you respected the rules, written and unwritten, of the Senate. How many other things like that are there that are, I mean, I guess a question like that, you'd almost have to seem to remember.
Unwritten rules? Well, you take the Senate we're the only Senate in the state, in the country, that you set Democrats, Republicans intermixed, not separated. A lot of Senates are separated. And the founders decided to do that so that you wouldn't necessarily vote as a block. You would vote your own conscience. And that's worked pretty well. I mean, but it is a tradition. It's also a tradition that whatever appointment is made through advised consent, you go to that senator where that person's from and get their okay. And that's not a written rule, but we respect that and we go by that, because if that senator isn't okay with that appointment, doesn't get a hearing, never appointed.
Back to Governor Nixon's time, probably one of the darkest times was during Ferguson and some of the unrest at Mizzou. I think it's hard for some of the people that listen to this to understand outstate Missouri's view of that. What was your view of that as somebody that's from St. Louis, lived in St. Louis, from Joplin?
I just don't know what happened. I mean, I just wasn't involved in that. I do know that whatever happened to Mizzou, it cost them a whole bunch of kids, and parents were upset at the university.
I think it's cost St. Louis a similar type of PR issue.
Well, maybe then. I don't think it has anymore, because apparently there's been a recognition that there's been some problems, they're working through it. I mean, Schmidt had that Senate Bill 5 that's trying to, I think that was started out, and I think Democrats, Republicans have tried to figure out a way to make things better. I hope so. I mean, I really just don't know how that happened, what happened, and I wasn't brought into on the police side or the public safe side. I don't know really what happened.
So the first tax cut came under your time in the Senate. I've listened to you temper some of your colleagues about cutting taxes too much.
Well, what I want to remind them is make sure you understand the ramification of the tax cuts that you had before you get anxious about another one. I mean, you don't want to go too far without understanding. You still have to do business. That's not to say that tax reduction is not important. I just felt that you shouldn't go too fast and make sure you cut expenses at the same time, and sometimes that neither one of them works. So I'm just, move slow. I think the machine works better when it works slow and you don't make any mistakes.
Interesting part of Republican politics is guns and abortion, probably the two things folks run on maybe more than anything else. I've watched you be very pro-gun, but even sometimes Sharia law and outlawing federal statutes. Do you think Republicans run the risk of trying to maybe overpreen and prompt on those issues?
Well, I guess you could say that. However, if you remember Tom Demption and I killed a gun bill.
That's what I'm saying.
I mean, that you think that was pleasurable? I had to have the police in Joplin guard my house, so I had my grandkids inside for 5 days because it's going to shoot me. I had threats on my wife, my grandkids, and me because I killed that bill. And the bill was unconstitutional. It wouldn't allow cooperation between locals and Fed. It also had a provision that if you had a child in a school and you had some public safety officers doing some things, that they wouldn't have to go to the parent. I mean, it was froth with wrong decisions. And I just said, I just can't make myself vote for this thing. And I had some guys in the Senate that should have voted with me and didn't. But a couple of them asked me. I said, don't worry about it. You're up for election. Go ahead and do it. Dempsey and I said, we'll take one for the team, and we did.
There was a lot of people, I thought, that left that chamber glad you did that and wishing they would have, but not really wanting to take the hiding their grandkids 5 days over it.
I think so.
You talk about one that when I actually stayed, it was a thing called SGR 39. It was something to do with gay people.
Cake thing and Andre did, yeah.
I stayed that night all night. I thought you guys were going to be done, and then something happened and you weren't. So I took the 11 o'clock to 6 in the morning or 8 in the morning shift. I did not sense people in leadership very proud or happy with how that ended, where you PQ'd that.
You had to get out of it. We couldn't get to a compromise.
Could you not have laid it over?
I couldn't get that person to do that.
If you had your marble back, would that end that way?
I would. We were in filibuster for 80 some hours straight. I was on the dais for maybe 60 hours straight, maybe 70. I don't remember. I didn't take too much time off because there was a lot of points of order had to rule on and just a lot of stuff going on in the Senate. I think I would have probably would have worked with Sifton a little harder to get a compromise, try to get earlier. However, every 4 hours, I asked my caucus, are you want to continue or you want to stop? And they all said, we want to continue. We think it's worth the battle. So I didn't make that decision by myself. Keelan and I didn't make that decision by ourselves. We checked with the caucus every 4 hours for 80 hours.
Do you think it turned into a we're not going to lose instead of we're really glad that we want to do?
Oh, yeah, both sides. And that probably set a standard for what happened after that on some issues with, you take that bill, number of labor bills and tort bills that we managed to get through without moving the previous question. I think people didn't want to get in that situation again. And, I was sitting there with Schmidt and Schaefer and Kehoe was trying to figure out how to get out of that, take some to caucus, and we finally did. And I was on the dais when we moved the previous question. But as it turned out, as the right decision, I don't know, Supreme Court justified, U.S. Supreme Court, real on what, last year or something. So maybe it's right, maybe it's wrong. I don't know, but that probably could have handled it better.
You PQ'd passing right to work once.
Mm-hmm.
It looked as though your caucus left feeling that was warranted and they felt good about it.
Yeah.
The time Nixon vetoed it, I didn't see that when you left over the other thing.
Yeah.
You PQ'd an abortion bill in veto session. It looked like your caucus felt like they were doing the right thing then. I didn't pick that up that night.
Well, and that's why, there was a sense that members weren't sure they was on solid ground. That's why I checked with them. Keogh and I checked with them every 4 or 5 hours. And they said it continued. I mean, we had to pull the plug on because Mike could have laid it over or we could have adjourned and stopped debate. We could have done something parliamentary and got him out of it. They want to continue. So, again, I go back to these members. I mean, we go where they want to go, and they thought it was important. Now, 2/3 into that, some of them probably wish they had them, but it's probably something that we could have worked out a little bit
better. Tell me about passing right to work to the first time, even though the governor vetoed it.
Oh, the governor vetoed several, that way, yeah.
You made several points of order. It had a feeling like it had a heavy air to it, and it had a feeling like that must have been a heck of an accomplishment when you left that night.
Well, the Senate passed right to work, and the House couldn't pass it one time, and then we passed it. I believe in my heart. I traveled with Bob Holden, and we were talking to the Japanese in New York City because I was trying to figure out an angle to get a Toyota truck plant went to San Antonio. And I said, what is it going to take? What is it going to take for Missouri to get a Toyota plant? And the Japanese assistant, she said, you got to have some regulatory reform. You guys are moving towards that. You got to have a decent pool of labor, and I think you're probably in good shape for that. and you got to have a utility schedule that's reasonable and not over. And you got to have a right to work. And I thought Bob Holden's going to choke. He said it right in front of me and Bob Holden. And then after doing economic development as mayor and going around the state, I believe it's a catalyst that it's a win for everybody. I don't believe it, that it cuts pay. And if you look at the states, unions are growing in non-union states because their business is thriving. I mean, we're hosting this event in St. Louis in a few days. Most of the states, if not all of them, are right to work, and they're all our competition. The reason that I'm in the Southern Legislative Conference is to see what they're doing as far as transportation, job creation, which Dixon, chair our economic development department, is modeling after Georgia and Alabama, which I think when he gets done, we're going to have a model that's going to be better than anybody's that we've been working on for 7 or 8 years. We just couldn't find the right model. And right to work, I think Texas, Florida, I mean, it's something, whether it passed or not, I don't know, but it's out there. I think it's a good idea. People think it's not, but
that's one override you didn't do of Nixon, but you override Nixon a ton, more than any other governor.
Yeah.
Feel good about him? Too many? I think he may feel like there was a little too many vetoes when I interviewed him.
Well,
maybe a little quick with that pen.
Maybe, but we had trouble dealing with some of his staff of trying to negotiate before we got there. I mean, he'll tell you as a former senator, too, that, you know, we have a direction and we think it's important and we'd like to have a little compromise, and at the end of the day, we won.
A lot of times. Talk about that trip to Normandy. Ryan McKenna told me a story that you were in Normandy.
Oh, McKenna and me and Jay Nixon.
Yeah, and he said a little girl walked up and thanked you for being an American and what America had done for her village.
Governor Nixon, I was privileged enough to go to the air show with him a couple of times. We made a side trip to Normandy, and we're sitting there, and this couple comes up, and you can tell they were poor, but they had on their best clothes. A little French village down the road, and they're coming up, and this little girl has a poem, and Governor Nixon has that poem. I wish I had a copy of it. You ought to ask him for that. He still has it. And during when the Normandy invasion, there was some U.S. or British, we believe they're U.S., fighter pilots circling, and one got shot down, and it was headed for the village. And this fighter pilot pushed this plane over and landed outside the village to save the village. To that day, and it turned out to be an American flyer. And that French community comes every year and decorates that flyer's grave every year. And if you go to Normandy and look at these graves, the nicest graveyard, Arlington, whatever, in the United States, doesn't bear a candle to what's at Normandy. I mean, they're in a blade of grass out, they're all in line, and they're all decorated. And at Normandy, and if you want to go something a step more, you go to Belgium. And they're really serious about the American GIs and all the Allied forces and the respect they give. And they did. They thanked the governor and McKenna and I. And, you know, I'm not too soft-hearted, but it just choked you up, this little girl. And she's got to be five generations away from this happening. But that community never forgot the GIs that lost their life coming over as allies.
So you take a trip with Governor Nixon. You probably know more about the job than anybody running at the time. Did you think about running for governor in 2016?
No. We walked into NATO. And I was walking, Governor Nixon was talking to someone. I walked ahead, and I was walking to some four-star, and he was telling me this and this, and I said, "Well, General, what?" He said, "Well, Governor, I'm trying to explain to you about what we're doing. We're getting ready to build this new big NATO. This here is 60 years old." I said, "Well, Governor, I don't want to embarrass you, but I'm not the governor. Sat back there." Because I combed my hair a little bit different back then, and Nixon and I did look a little bit similar there, but no, I didn't think I was going to run for governor. You got to be cut above. There's a couple of people. Parsons going to be a good governor. Mike Kehoe's going to be a good governor if he ever gets a chance to be a great lieutenant governor. There's some other people that's coming up through the ranks. It'll be, and besides, I'm 71 years old. I started at 55. I mean, that's, you got to have to.
Well,
you know,
that was Parson.
Early 60s.
He's a little behind you, yeah.
He's 10 years, but that's a lot of, you know, that's 24/7. You know, I did 24/7 in the House and in the Senate, and that takes a toll on
sure.
you.
So
and
when you,
that place will kill you if you let it. The Capitol will kill you if you let it.
You've watched a lot of races. I figure you had at least a week or two where you thought Eric Grimes would win the governor's race.
Yeah. I mean, I just checked the polling.
Trends that
way. I mean, yeah, it is what
so
it was.
Did you think after he won there would be a personal relationship or a communication that would be different than the campaign rhetoric?
Yeah, I did Bob Holden's economic development. I did Matt Blunt, Jay Nixon. I mean, all of them, I thought there'd be some sort of a back and forth, and there was none. I mean, he was pretty tight.
After the election, did you meet with him, or how'd that?
Not very often. Occasionally. But, you know, he was feeling his way. I wish you'd just let me have my head. I'd have made him a hero. I wouldn't go to embarrass anybody. But he had a different perspective,
well,
and then
some
things.
Some of it was good, though. I mean, but there was
yeah,
a time.
Yeah, some of it was good. Yeah, he was just hard to figure out. You know, he just didn't. He was.
Well, a story I've written about that I found interesting. There was a night early on about the pay increase.
Yeah.
And he starts. The debate, it wasn't the night it went into effect. It was the night before. And you guys have a few people that are, I think Senator Brown wasn't there yet or something. And people start objecting that they're not going to vote. And he starts tweeting. And then he ends up, I guess, is it in your office?
Yeah, he wanted to come down and see if he could visit with some of the senators. Was no. I said, well, that's fine. Go ahead. And he did. I was there for one or two of his meetings for a few minutes. It got a little intense, so I left. I didn't really care about him the way some of my senators were treated, so I left.
It looked from the popcorn gallery I get to sit and watch in that after that night you became more protective of some of your members.
Well, I had to. Yeah.
It looked like that night was a change in a little bit of your demeanor towards the second floor.
Yeah, we went on the offense pretty good. Yeah. We went on the offense.
We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance, and we're for the Missouri way of life. We're for worrying less about the what-ifs and more about the why-nots. We're for checking off your bucket list and then making a new one. For starting a family, a business, a tradition. And if you find yourself starting over, we're here for that too. We're for building a life in Missouri, and then going out and living it. And when it comes to making sure everything you've built is protected, we're for you. We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance.
The Show Me Missouri podcast is brought to you by our friends at HALO, Heartland Area Landowners. HALO is a membership-based organization for folks interested in farming the sun and the wind. HALO members are passionate about their land, our world, and stewarding the resources that feed America, power, and its economy. Farming the sun and wind has incredible benefits for farmers, landowners, and all Missouri communities, all while helping secure America's energy independence. To learn more about HALO and how you can get involved, visit heartlandowners.farm. That's heartlandowners.farm.